Line One brings you this special presentation of Out North's Mental Health Mosaics. Welcome to Mental Health Mosaics from Out North, an arts nonprofit located in Anchorage, Alaska, on the unceded traditional lands of the Dene Ina people. I'm Ann Hillman. The first part of this episode is about suicide, what it's like to lose someone to suicide, and why it's so important to talk about this issue openly. If you are thinking about suicide or know someone who is, you can always call the care line at 877-266-4357, anytime, any day. You can also dial 988. Suicide is not an easy topic to discuss or hear about, and it's an issue that disproportionately affects veterans and Indigenous men in the United States. But talking about suicide can help people heal. Victoria Taylor lost her mother to suicide in 2013 when she was in her mid-20s. This is Victoria.
I think the first thing that we have to acknowledge is that relationships between mothers and daughters are often complicated. I was no exception to that. My mom was no exception to that. The only difference, I think, then, you know, between myself and my friends was that there was a mental health aspect involved. I think obviously how I've processed my relationship with my mom as an adult is very different than what it felt like when I was growing up and experiencing it at that time. But I think, you know, my mom was very young when she had me. She was 18. And I think that probably played a little bit in our dynamic as well. Just, you know, being so young and then having a child and another person that you have to look out for. But I think there were times in my childhood where I think that my mom was doing better than at other times. And in those times, I have really good memories, you know, of her being, you know, at my softball games or being more present. But they are often overshadowed by the times where I know that she was navigating her mental health and struggling with depression. And then as I got older, she also became an alcoholic. And so that certainly complicated things. And my mom did attempt suicide when I was 9 years old, to the first time that I remember it. And at that time, I don't remember the alcohol being a part of it. But then by the time I was a teenager and certainly in my early 20s, she had developed alcoholism, and it was much more complicated and so much harder to deal with, I think. And I think also when I was a kid, I had the shield of adults, right? Mm-hmm. I had my dad, I had my grandmother. And then as I grew up, those things weren't so present at the time. You know, my parents had divorced, and so I lived with my dad for 2 weeks, and then I'd go to my mom's house for 2 weeks, and the dynamics were completely different at each house. So with my mom, I think that our relationship sort of became, as I grew up, where I sort of started to take care of her. And that was hard. And I think that once she died, I held on to a lot of the feelings associated with that, and it was confusing and heavy. I know that sounds like such a basic way to describe it, but it was. And when you look back, yeah, I think there was maybe some anger that played into it for sure.
I wonder if you remember when you were younger and your mom was in a really dark, depressive state. How did you navigate that? What became like your role and her role?
I think my mom was doing the best she could for where she was at the time. And I say that from a place of forgiveness and offering a lot of grace. Because when I look back at, for instance, after my mom's first attempt, right? Once she came back from having gone through a mental institute and some inpatient therapy, once she came back, I think that it was hard for her to be a mom and work on herself. And I don't think that she could focus on being a mom in the way that we would all like to think that you could be taking care of another person, right? And I would say that's when I really am able to reflect and see that the dynamics changed. And it's so small, but as significant as, like, I was making dinner you know, and doing those things. And I remember waking her up to take me to school. But I realize now, I think that, like, she was doing the best she could, you know. And that's why I think that dynamic at my dad's house was so different, because I had a curfew there and he was making us dinner. And so that in itself was really interesting to shift every 2 weeks in that cycle. And I think, like, my mom was, like I said, she was super young when she had me. And I think that there, as I got older, it was more like friendship. You know, I became my mom's friend. And I think there's nothing wrong with that, like, to be close with your parents, but maybe not when you're a teenager. Like, maybe not in those formative years. And certainly when we're talking about, like, already I had been sort of taking care of her in that sense. And, you know, I think the area, it's one thing to be able to sit here and say, like, well, yeah, I mean, I would make dinner, or, you know, I would wake my mom up to take me to school. That's very different than where, when she would come back, you know, from the inpatient therapy, or, you know, whatever the situation was, not knowing what she needed, and not, like, hearing that, not hearing her verbalize it or be able to communicate that, I think would have been maybe beneficial to know how we could have supported her, you know, when she did come back and try to get back to normal, because obviously, like, taking care of a kid was a lot to ask.
When she came back, were there any extra supports? Was there any, did anyone talk to you about what was going on?
I just remember it being sort of like, well, your mom's sick, she needs help, kind of thing, you know, and not just from my dad, I mean, from my grandmother. And I don't think that we had these conversations about, like, what's actually happening here. I don't know, because I was a kid with the first attempt anyway, I don't know if doctors were honest enough, like, to say, here's what we see in Angela, you know, and here's what we recommend as a family. I don't know if that ever happened. And I've never asked, which is, you know, shame on me for not looking into it more. But I do remember, as I got older, and certainly into my 20s, we knew something was wrong. But I don't remember us as a family collectively saying, like, could we go into a family therapy situation? Like, what do we need to do to give her support? And I think, like, as basic as it is, having conversations would have opened up so much understanding, I think.
When Victoria was in her early 20s, she moved on her own to Alaska from the southeastern United States for a job.
Our relationship at that time, my mom and I, it had gotten really bad. That's when she was drinking the heaviest that I can recall. And I got to a point where I wasn't checking in, calling home regularly with my mom. And the last time we spoke was actually on Christmas Eve, which was also her birthday. So she, that was 2012, and then she passed away in January. And it wasn't a good conversation. I know now that my mom on the other line was not my mom. And I say that meaning, you know, she was in a dark place, and that wasn't my mom. Like, that was also, the alcohol clearly was playing into it that night, and it just wasn't a good conversation. And then fast forward 3 weeks, and my dad called and told me that my mom had passed away and died by suicide. So then I, you know, went back to Georgia, and I think at first I didn't realize, like, on the phone what he was telling me. I don't think I expected the phone call, but I wasn't also completely surprised, if that makes sense.
What was it like to grieve her?
I felt a lot of guilt for a very long time. That was the biggest one. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we weren't, our relationship wasn't in a good place, and even now, you know, 9 years later, sometimes I question, like, if my mom were still alive, would we have patched things up? Would we have gotten her more help? You know, like, what would it be like? How would it be different? I don't know those answers, and I won't know those answers. But I'm okay with that now. And for a long time, I wasn't. And I think that the guilt of feeling like, you know, I had turned my back on her, and that's a lot to process, and it was hard.
Were you able to talk to people and say how she died, or you just said?
I was always actually very open in that it was death by suicide. Yeah, I always felt okay to tell people that. And I don't know if it was because of like this pull to help destigmatize, you know, I think that that's that word, even, you know, growing up, I recall it being just like whispered, right? I don't think that we're in that world anymore. At least I'm not living in that world anymore. And so, yeah, I was always able to admit that that's how she died. Because I don't think there's anything wrong with that, right? I mean, people ask, you say, you know, so-and-so died. They ask, what happened? And I think honesty is the best approach in that. And I think that it has afforded me to have some really great conversations with total strangers even. And so I see that as a positive to come out of this.
Victoria said it took her 5 years before she could honor her mother's wishes and spread her ashes. First, she had to let go of her own guilt about her mother's death, forgive her mother, and learn to understand how mental health issues affect people and their support networks in a huge variety of ways. She said many things helped her get through the long grieving process, including encouraging family members to talk about the way she died.
I know that in the year since my mom died, there have been some moments, you know, where of honesty in our family that maybe not everyone wanted, but I think that that's really healthy. And for me, that has been supportive, right? And having candid conversations and realizing that, like, you're an adult at the table now and you're getting to be treated like an adult at the table, not like they're sugarcoating it for you. And, you know, does that look like traditional support? No, I don't think so. But I think it is 100%. And I think you can be really responsive to that. When my mom comes up, they're complicated conversations. And we have them, I think, as a family. And, you know, certainly I think with my dad, who I would, you know, it's so different too, because, you know, my grandmother lost her daughter. My dad lost, you know, what I would say was probably the love of his life. I think he would agree with that too. And then I lost my mom, and how we all respond to those is very different, right? But I think, like, in at least being honest with each other, there's something there. There's something valid in how we're working through that loss, even now.
For people who are listening to your story, and for others who or grieving a person dying by suicide, what would you tell them?
I think that we have to be aware of timelines being different for everyone, and, like, don't try to rush through it. Like, and I say that meaning that, like, you may think that you're through, you know, stage XYZ, but, like, you're going to hear a song on the radio one day and it's going to hit you differently, and the holidays are going to hit you differently every year. And that's completely normal. I think it's, like, totally fine to embrace that and recognize that, you know what, some days are just harder, and that's okay. I think I would strongly encourage others to use the loss of their loved one as an opportunity to connect with others. When you're a survivor of suicide loss, you are united with this. Unfortunately, it's a large group of us. It's an understanding with strangers that you'll have. And I would encourage you to connect with those. I think it helps you understand what you've experienced, but also what your loved one was experiencing. And that's complicated.
Victoria says she still doesn't understand her mother, but she's had to come to peace with that, with all of the questions she still has, and with what she won't get to experience with her.
I think for my own health, I have to be. Right. Yeah. I think for a while I wasn't. And I think that was probably the anger part for me, you know, like realizing, you know, on the from a very, like, superficial level, you can have those thoughts of, like, well, now my mom won't be making, like, my flowers for my wedding and things like that. Right. But it's so much more than that. And it really is. Well, like, now I don't get to ask her those questions when I'm ready. And that opportunity is not going to present itself. So I think yeah, I have to be okay with that. And a large part of that, and you know, certainly how I've looked at healing is not being afraid to talk about what happened and my experience, and also recognizing like everyone's going to be in a different situation and everyone's going to experience things differently. But this is how it was for me. And that's kind of all I can do at this point.
Healing from a suicide loss can be really hard. And as Victoria shared, talking about it can help. Talking about suicide can also help prevent people from dying that way. And no, a discussion about suicide won't put it into a person's mind. That's a myth. Chris Green teaches suicide intervention classes with Cook Inlet Tribal Council in Anchorage. She teaches people how to talk openly and safely about suicide. She started the work for very personal reasons.
I came to Alaska in 79, had met and married my husband. And we moved up here and created a life and a family, and we had been married for 27 years when I got a call one day. Mrs. Scheib, I'm sorry to inform you, your husband's dead.
The news of her husband's unexpected death hit Chris incredibly hard.
And it started me on a very challenging path with four teenage sons, two of which were involved in the accident and the trauma. And there were hills and valleys with them. And I knew I needed to get them to high school. And when they graduated and walked across that stage 2 days later, I found myself on the edge of a cliff.
Chris says she developed a suicide plan.
The one thing that stopped me from lining up those pills and reading and following through on the recipe that I had Googled that day was knowing that my son, who was living abroad studying, would get that very phone call and there would be nobody to help him. So that's my story, my own very personal story. But I had a grandfather who died, likely by suicide, prior to my birth even, and it really changed how my dad parented as a result, I believe. Suicide has this incredible ripple effect. He was, our family, a Roman Catholic family, saw suicide as a grievous sin, and my dad could never believe it was suicide, and that he didn't go to heaven. I've had sister-in-laws, several who have died, close friends who have died by suicide, uncles who have died by suicide. So there is this ripple effect of suicide in the community as a result of just the energy of that occurring in the community, that people are so desperate, that they are so profoundly overwhelmed that they cannot live life, and that they want the pain to go away. They want relief from the pain. They don't necessarily want to die. They just don't want to keep feeling this bad. And that is the story that I want to change, because I know that kindness makes a difference. Talking about suicide makes a difference. Bringing the subject to light makes a difference. And having the skills and words and tools to not be afraid, to not run, and to talk about it can make the difference.
Why does talking about it make a difference?
People need to be heard. They need their stories to be heard. They need the pain to be elevated. They need to know they are not alone. They need to know that there is resources and help out there, that they aren't crazy, that in what is happening is that they are overwhelmed and they really don't want to die. They just want the pain to go away. So how do you do that? And when you're isolated, alone, and not in conversation with people or loved ones, or you made some bad decisions, mm-hmm. and there are consequences for sometimes some bad decisions, and people just need to know that there are going to be options instead of trying to kill themselves to avoid pain, the embarrassment, whatever.
Chris says it's really common for people to have fleeting thoughts about suicide. Most people do at one time or another.
You're not crazy to have it, because when we get overwhelmed, it is a fight or flight response, and it is common occurrence. It is when people have multiple layers of things. We all have stressors in our life. We all have things that come along. A brand new baby, wonderful, but to some people, not so wonderful. Or postpartum depression, or any number of things. Financial distress, loss of a job, end of a relationship. Lots of people experience these things. They all contribute to these potential thoughts. Well, some people just don't have the ability to filter them and to stay on the safe side of this bridge or dam, so to speak. And they fall into what is called the river of suicide. And then they start having more thoughts of suicide, and they begin to fantasize or imagine getting the relief from the pain. And once they fall into the river of suicide and they float along, and then nobody talks about it or says, you're not crazy, you just need help, you need a lifeline, somebody will help you. If they don't toss that in, people just keep on floating down the river until they fall over the edge and then make an attempt.
Chris says you can intervene by talking directly about suicide. Focus on helping that person be safe for now, not for a lifetime, just for now.
It's really as simple as, I really care about you, Anne. I'm so sorry you're having some troubles. You look really down. You're saying some things that have me concerned. The hair on the back of my neck is standing up like there is something going on, Anne, and I'm concerned about you. Are you having thoughts of suicide? That's how you start the conversation. But there are things when we run into people who just need somebody to ask them, to say the words out loud. Okay, so we're talking about suicide. Okay, that doesn't scare me. I am not going to run. I will sit with you and stay with you until we can keep you safe for now. Let's figure out what we can do together to disable this plan that you have, to strengthen and bolster your safety plan, and where you can go for additional help if I'm not the person who's going to be able to do that.
Okay.
So it's keeping somebody safe for now does not mean, one, you have to solve all of their financial issues, get them in a new relationship. You certainly can't bring, you know, somebody back from the dead if that is the event that has created the scenario. But you can stay with somebody so that, number one, they're not alone. Number two, you're willing to talk about it. Because most people, the vast majority of people, don't want to talk about it. They simply run. And then the person is further isolated. I really am crazy. In fact, nobody wants to hang with me anymore.
If somebody brings it up to you, mm-hmm. and somebody says, I'm thinking about suicide, mm-hmm. how do you respond?
Thank you for trusting me. And I'm not going to go anywhere until we talk about this and we come up with a plan to keep you safe for now, because you telling me that you're having thoughts of suicide is very serious. But I'm not scared of the conversation. And I'm going to stay with you until we figure this out.
Okay. Someone once said to me that one thing she's learned to do is to acknowledge that suicide is a choice. Mm-hmm. And if you just cut off the conversation and like, no, don't do that, it means you're not listening, really.
Correct. Exactly. If you do not acknowledge that suicide is a choice, absolutely, you are saying you are not listening to me. You are not listening to me. I will only be able to work through this if I see suicide as a choice. As well as, despite our very best efforts, sometimes people die by suicide. They make that choice. So it is also a mindset that we need to acknowledge that they made a choice for our own healing and self-preservation.
It feels to me like you're saying, like, you have to acknowledge that it was their choice so you don't take the blame. You don't go through the, what if I had done X? What if I had done this, that?
Right. You, me, and John Q. Public. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs to understand that concept, that suicide is a choice by an individual, not one we ever want them to make and never encourage somebody to make. But it also relieves us of the guilt and the burden of the what ifs. I should have, I could have, what did I do wrong? All of those what ifs that happen in life.
You can't take responsibility for a person's choice, but you can do something, even if that something is just sitting quietly with them.
If you are so concerned and they don't want to talk, you just sit in presence and in silence. It's amazing what silence will do to somebody who is having thoughts of suicide, feeling desperate and alone. And somebody is just going to sit there, not pressure them. Just sit in silence and companionship. It's often, people who are grieving, that's what they need. There's no magic pixie dust that's going to help somebody who's grieving profoundly, like I did. I had profound grief. And when I was at my lowest, somebody who just sat with me silently and stayed with me made all the difference in the world. I didn't need direction. I didn't need somebody telling me what to do. I didn't need someone else's bias. I just needed to not be alone. And isn't that profound? Small acts of kindness can have a profound effect on somebody who's having thoughts of suicide. They don't feel so alone.
If in this moment you need to feel less alone, please call 988 or the Alaska Care Line at 877-266-4357. Talking about suicide is just one aspect of talking about mental health. After the break, we'll hear about other ways people encourage intergenerational conversations about the topic.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're hurting in your relationship or have been affected by sexual violence, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is a free 24/7 confidential and anonymous domestic, dating, and sexual violence helpline for Alaska Natives. Help is available by calling or texting 1-844-7-NATIVE or using the chat icon at strongheartshelpline.org. This message is sponsored by the Strong Hearts Native Helpline.
Welcome back to this special presentation of Mental Health Mosaics from Out North. I'm Ann Hillman. On this program, we spent a lot of time talking about the really hard stuff, like racism and oppression, and how do you get people to open up if they're thinking of suicide. But mental health is so much broader than those issues. It's the good stuff and the bad, the things in our past that we're still processing, and the things in our present that give us strength to keep going. In this segment, we'll hear two very different perspectives on the everyday of talking about mental health and listen to some music as well. To start, we'll hear from Georgiana Nigluk and Abraham Rivers from Scammon Bay. Just a heads up, Scammon Bay is pretty remote and their internet sometimes cuts out a little, making the Zoom recording a little choppy. Georgiana and Abraham say they grew up living in two worlds. Both are connected to their Yupik culture through their families and the land, but they also had to live in a Western world. Here's Abraham.
With my dad hunting, he wouldn't take us out hunting. you know, he'd stop and he'd make sure we know where we're at, you know the land, know the rivers. So, you know, you go out, you know, you'll know where you're at, you'll know where to hunt, you can watch where all the birds fly. You can't just go out hunting and think you'll catch. You got to know, you know, what the birds do. You pay attention. He always said, pay attention to what you're doing. And that brought us a long way. I was lucky, you know. I'm lucky. I was lucky to have my mom and dad, because they taught, you know, just like Georgiana's mom and dad. You know.
Abraham says his dad also taught him that if he wanted things like snow machines, he had to earn money and buy them himself. He learned about finances and Western systems. Now Abraham and Georgiana run a program called Konazvik, which means toolbox in Yupik. It's focused on substance use prevention and reasons for living. During the program, they work with other community members to take youth out to harvest from the land, teach them different survivor skills, and to talk. Through these activities, they are connecting youth with the full community and with culture. Georgiana explains that all of these experiences, learning new skills, connecting with people, understanding Yupik values, are protective factors for youth. It supports their long-term mental health.
When you go out and you do something and you're able to, you know, give your catch or what you gathered to elders or even to you, just to give it to your family, how good it makes the youth feel to be able to provide, it gives them like meaning. They feel a part of the community. They feel like they're providing for their family. And it's just a good feeling to be able to do that. And a big thing that we stress on with the youth is to keep busy. You have to keep busy so your mind won't be busy. And it's not only for the youth. You know, I have to remind myself the same thing. And I'm an adult. I have to be busy so my mind won't be busy. So that's a big thing that we were taught growing up is, you know, they're self-occupied. Because if you're idle for too long, your mind really does wander.
Just being out and being out, having the kids out is healing. You're out, and you can think out loud of your life, you know, of what we have, and that's what I do. You know, I when I'm out, you know, I could think openly and think about what I want to talk to my kids about, and or with the kids that we bring. We have our potlatches in April. You know, kids that get their first catch will visitors will come and they'll give them to elders. You know, it's not only good for the kids. You know, the elders are so happy because that's you know, they do it all the time, but they're always so appreciative for that, because you know that's been around forever. You know, going back from years and years.
They did it for a reason. To the first catches, the whole catch was distributed, and the family kept none of it. And they would tell us, if you did that, then you would get more. And that's a big part of our culture, is giving and expecting nothing in return. All of these things that we do build character for our kids. So, I mean, I remember when I got my first moose and I gave it all away, I felt really good. And I know I witnessed it with the youth, because over the years, so many of them got their first catches. And, you know, when we were able to land a couple of whales, we announced, and the community, we announced a little early. So when we got to the, we call it the new road where we park our boats, there's a big crowd waiting, and you know, the kids felt so good about that, and it was all over social media about how grateful they were for the program and these families that wouldn't get the whale, the meat and the skin, were able to put them away because of the youth providing for them through their first catches. And you know, that's been something that we've been doing a lot. And it's not only catches, it's other things that, you know, Abraham mentioned price of fuel. We have a lot of people here have wood stoves, and Abraham throughout the winter is able to go out with youth and provide willows for wood heat in their homes, and it saves so much. It saves us all so much money to be able to heat our home through wood heat. And even on the rainiest days, the kids were showing up, and I was curious, so I asked one of the youth, why do you show up even if it's like this? And his response was, I like to see the elders' reaction when we give them the wood. It gives the kids reasons for life, and that's exactly what Kunazivik is. You know, if when the kids provide with the elders or community members things, it makes them feel good about themselves. It makes them feel good about providing, and that gives you reasons for life. They also learn things like responsibility, how to properly, you know, when you provide something, you need to make it presentable. That also teaches them respect. You know, we try to make everything as clean as possible when we do these things. We come back and we wash the boats when we're done. And it's so that connection that you're talking about is giving our youth reasons for living, especially the part where we talk about how it makes them feel good inside.
They also speak to youth directly when they see them struggling. They give them encouraging words and try to make them feel less alone. They also use outings as a chance to talk more deeply.
Sometimes I can, you know, just interacting with this person one time can make a big difference, you know. You know, just by smiling at this kid or talking to this kid, letting them know you care, you know, that can carry a long way.
While the program helps expand the kids' vision of their lives, it also sets boundaries and expectations. Participants can't use drugs or alcohol while doing activities with Kunazvik.
My mom always used to tell us, boys and my sisters, that, you know, no matter how much you try to hide, there's always eyes watching you. So, you know, I use that with my kids, you know. I tell them, you know, you think you can get away with something once or twice, but there's, you know, we're all family here. We all look out for each other. We get a phone call, and you know, my son got caught smoking once, and me and my wife bought a carton of a pack of cigarettes and gave it to him and told him to smoke in front of us. Nope, never again.
It's emphasized on through the youth culture, respect. You have to have respect for the land. You have to have respect for your elders. You have to have respect for each other, and you have to have respect for yourself. And that's why I think with this discipline, that's why we discipline the way that we do, and a lot of it is talking and reverse psychology. Because, you know, when I've had it with my kids and they don't want to listen, I'll tell them to do what they were doing wrong, and they sit there and think, as young as they are. and they normally do stop after that. Just like what Abraham mentioned, I've seen my parents do the same thing. A big thing that my parents, when they would see me get sad or my siblings get sad when they were scolding us, they would say, I'm only doing this because I love you. I'm only talking to you like this because I love you.
Georgiana does the same thing for her kids and for the youth in the program.
But there are times that, you know, we hear about things in the community or through the school, whether it be bullying or other things. We don't directly talk to anybody. We talk to the group as a whole and mention that, you know, it's not a good thing to be doing these things that we want them to look out for each other, to be there for each other. And, you know, it lets them think, just like we said, we know what's going on, even though we're not out to see it ourselves. So that's another thing too, that if we hear about something, we talk about it. And we encourage them to do good, even outside of activities.
Knuzvik is based on thousands and thousands of years of Yupik culture, knowledge, and survival. So they have substantial evidence that it's a solid way to support mental health. That evidence is supplemented by research from the University of Alaska Fairbanks that also says participating in these activities and having intergenerational conversations and interactions gives young people reasons for living and reduces substance use. You can find links to more information about the program on our website, mentalhealthmosaics.org. Michaela Dickerson and Scott Joyce make up the Fairbanks R&B duo Dumoulin. They're also a married couple that's been together for more than 10 years, since their first year of college. In 2021, they wrote the song Nina, which was selected for the Mental Health Mosaics art show. The song is partly about what you'll never know about your loved one's pasts and how their trauma and life experiences shaped them. It's also about grieving. Found an old locked door. Got me thinking about it. Michaela first started writing the song, it was about their dog, Nina, and the life she led with her previous owners who passed away. Then it quickly morphed into something larger.
From that place, I came up with some melodies and started to kind of think about the song a little bit more, and it kind of transitioned into me kind of describing this larger than life person that I only got to experience like a little snippet of, right, as a child. And then just feeling lost and like I had missed out on an opportunity to really connect with someone that meant a lot to me. And I'm referring to my great-grandmother, Juanita Ingram.
Juanita Ingram, known as Big Mama, passed away during the first year of the COVID pandemic, and they couldn't travel to the funeral in Texas.
So we were able to just be like, nope, this is not happening right now. We're going to keep going with our lives until this song kind of just fell on our laps. And we were like, okay, we have to recognize that we are grieving. This is about someone that meant a lot to us. And let's have our own personal celebration of this person's life, pretty much.
And the parts of the life that we don't know. Right. I know she got into some things, you know? And yeah, it makes me smile to think about that, about all the different lives that she got to live and the small bit that I was able to be there with her and experience, and it changed me.
For me, I think Big Mama was just like, just a person that was so comfortable with themselves that they did not even like other people's opinions and thoughts about whatever they thought she was doing. Like, it didn't matter, whatever. Like, her fashion was beyond what we're doing right now, what anyone has ever done. Her personality was the same way. Like, she was just always genuinely like herself. And me, seeing someone so comfortable just being themselves, was just like, wow, I cannot wait to get there. I cannot wait to just not give any craps about what anyone has ever thought. Like, because I'm such an overthinker, and I've always been just anxious about all these little decisions, what other people are thinking. Like, that wasn't her at all, ever.
We don't know. Maybe it was when she was, you know, in her 20s or 30s, but not when we were kicking it with her in her 80s.
Right.
Writing the song got Michaela and Scott thinking more about understanding people's histories, including their own, and the lasting impact of those events.
I guess for my family, we have recently started having conversations more about like healing from our own just experiences growing up, and just asking more questions about like, did this happen? How did this happen? Just really getting at the depths of some of the sadness that maybe we haven't shared. We haven't actually gotten to the point of maybe talking about more of the like, who were you back then? What were your interests? Things like that. It's more like going in and being like unpacking your childhood. We're basically on level one, I'd say. And slowly we'll get there. But right now it's more of just the base level healing work.
You got to unpack that suitcase before you can fold the clothes and put them back in. Right.
And it's actually been really, really difficult work to do because we're all in various stages of learning about ourselves and, you know, trying to keep these relationships open and healthy, right? So you kind of have to walk this tightrope when you're talking about different difficult conversations. So that's we're at the beginning of that. It's something that I didn't know that I wanted or needed, but it's definitely making us a closer family for sure.
I'm really proud of Michaela and the folks for having that. And then I'm also embarrassed to admit my family has not done that at all. We have not begun to have those conversations. I don't know how they go. I don't think it would be met with resistance. We just have to find that moment to get everyone engaged, to get everyone to buy in, and just to have it, right? To have that spark to go and do it. But no, we haven't. We haven't talked like that. And I don't remember ever talking about things like that.
So I guess I'm kind of curious as to how you started.
So we have a blended family. So there's even more levels to it, right? So that makes it even more difficult. But my stepmom is an amazing woman that she has kind of been like this third party that has been able to see some of this tension, right? So she was a moderator for this and was like, there's tension. We need to address this tension and move forward, because I have younger siblings that are 2 and 9 or so. And so just to create, you know, a good base, we kind of have to go back and rehash. My dad likes to say rehash or relive. It's not, I don't really like that description of it, but just have a discussion concerning what happened, what didn't happen, what could have happened, if we would have known, you know, the ramifications of some of the actions, and just like having accountability conversations also is a whole other part of it. Like, just to build that trust going forward, I think. So yeah, it was really great to actually kind of have this built-in moderator who, you know, works in the educational system and is able to coach us through it, really.
Yeah. I never thought about it like that, but yeah. My stepmom also kind of was the impetus for me beginning to learn. Like, I didn't know my mom's real name until my stepmom like just dropped it in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how little my family had kind of talked. When my mom immigrated to America, she changed her name, and yeah, I didn't know anything about that and still don't. But yeah, it's amazing how sometimes that, I don't want to say tangential, but just like that outside perspective can allow you to examine things in a new light. And maybe their perspective of the family can just be so beneficial in that way, because mm-hmm. they see it in a completely different way, just like I do with your family, mm-hmm. you know?
Scott only knew tiny bits of his mother's history growing up. He knew his maternal grandmother died by suicide, but didn't know much else about his mom. His own childhood wasn't very stable, but he never understood why.
I kind of just thought it was because we were like lower middle class, I guess. Like, I think I just thought that's how a lot of people grew up. And then I'd go out to other people's houses and I was just like, wow, this family is great. Like, they have dinner together and they have like Pop-Tarts and cable TV. And like, I guess I just thought somehow that what we had was normal and that everything else was the exception. And maybe as I grew older, I realized it wasn't such a black and white dichotomy. And it was just my experience. And a lot of people had similar experiences and a lot of people had dissimilar experiences. And I don't know, I think as Michaela and a lot of our friends have been doing like incredible work exploring identity and place and trauma, a lot of times it's forced me, or allowed me rather, to start to look at that within my own family and my life. And I'm really thankful for that.
Thinking about the conversations you've had and not had about mental health, what would you tell other people who are also trying to navigate these family relationships and trying to navigate understanding the family that they're born with and building those relationships and having those conversations?
I guess for me, it never was a conscious shift. I think I had been doing other work. I had been seeking out new experiences and just meeting new people. And I think through that process of growth, it allowed me to get to a place of acceptance or being present or whatever that I don't think I would have gotten to if I had set out with that as my goal. And I think in some ways it just kind of coming as the natural phase of growing up and becoming an adult and becoming independent. You know, it just, I allowed myself to be present there for that.
Mm-hmm. I guess for me, I would say maybe do the work first, like for yourself, just so that there is not more harm done when you have these conversations and you're coming from an open, honest place. Like, you know, you're in tune with your own intentions and what you need so that you can be present and available for the people that you love.
I think a lot of these terms can be scary for me as well, right? You like some of this language around healing and mindfulness, can it can feel really flowery, it can feel very crunchy. And I have to fight my own biases of like turning off from that. But for one, you know, the English language is not perfect at describing these emotions. I think a lot of people know these emotions or can know these emotions within themselves, and they don't have to be quantified by words.
Michaela says she's ready for these deeper dives into the past and the present.
I'm like really hungry for it. I'm ready. Let's go back to family. Let's go back to self. Let's read a little bit more. Let's connect and have these beautiful relationships and think more about community. I'm hungry for it.
I kind of always thought I was just good doing anywhere, doing anything, like as long as I can eat, like I'm good. And lately I'd been thinking, well, that's just coming from a place of privilege, right? That's because I didn't have to confront that, or I didn't have to worry about those needs not being immediately met, because we've been doing good for a while. But now that we're talking it out, I wonder if it's also because of fear, because I don't want to expose myself to looking more. Maybe being present is just a way for me to be unavailable to those larger topics.
Of the past?
And of the self.
Okay.
And of how I relate to that. Because I don't really think about growing up at all. You think so much, you feel so hard. It makes me feel so vacuous sometimes, you know, like a husk. But yeah, maybe it's because I haven't allowed myself to do that. But I don't know how.
I'm actually really jealous of your ability to be that present. So we're learning a lot from each other.
We should be partners or something.
That was Michaela Dickerson and Scott Joyce, the members of Dumoulin, talking about exploring the past and how that can help you understand your own mental health. This episode was edited by Jenna Schnur, produced by me, Anne Hillman, with audio mixing by Dave Waldron. Our theme music is by Aria Phillips. Mental Health Mosaics receives funding from the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and the Alaska State Council for the Arts. You can find out more by going to mentalhealthmosaics.org. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.